Today at Reader's Corner, Lyanda Lynn Haupt, author of Mozart's Starling. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart is revered as an 18th century genius who composed some of the most sublime music ever written. The fact that a starling became his beloved pet during one of the most creative and productive periods of his short life has perplexed historians and music lovers for years. Yet the unlikely story of the great composer and his common bird is a true one, and today's guest, Lyanda Lynn Haupt, explores it in detail in her book titled Mozart's Starling. Starlings are native to Europe, where Mozart lived, but they are an invasive species in North America and are widely despised for their many bad habits. But as Miss Haupt writes, starlings are also smart, curious, and beautiful, something she discovered firsthand when she adopted a starling chick as part of her research for the book. On this last weekend of 2017, we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Lyanda Lynn Haupt. She is a naturalist, philosopher, and author of several books, including The Urban Bestiary, Crow Planet, which won the 2010 Sigurd F. Olsen Writing Award. She lives in Seattle, where she joins us by phone for this interview. Lyanda Lynn Haupt, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. I am happy to be here.
So, Lyanda, that's over 300 years ago, or around 300 years, whatever it is. How do we know, or what do we know about Mozart and his pet starling?
That's a great question. The only reason that we know anything about Mozart's starling is that for a very short time, Mozart kept a little pocket notebook in which he recorded all of his expenses. Uh-huh. And it's kind of a funny thing because Mozart wrote, you know, thousands of letters, and he kept careful track of his finished compositions. But other than that, he was a terrible record keeper, and he didn't keep track of anything at all. And I kind of have a feeling that we have Constanza, his wife, to thank for this. But in my imagination, she gave him this notebook and said, honey, I want you to write down everything you spend money on, because he was kind of a spender, and she was the home economist. And I have a feeling they had a chat over the expense notebook at the end of every week. But anyway, in this little notebook that he kept for just a short time, we see a little line where he records that he spent a few kreutzer on a starling bird. And beneath the record of this expense, he writes a line from the motif of his beautiful piano concerto in G major that he had just finished, but he had not yet performed publicly. And underneath that, he wrote a line copying over the way the starling in the shop where he bought the starling sang that same motif. So the starling he bought was mimicking the motif that he had written. And for Mozart, where starlings were common and people knew about their natural history, the fact of it being able to mimic the motif wouldn't have been a surprise. For most of us here, we don't know that starlings are wonderful mimics. They're as good as parrots. They're better than crows and jays, and they can imitate, you know, human language and environmental sounds and music. So the mystery to us, and maybe to Mozart, was how the bird learned his motif, since it hadn't been in public yet. But he recorded the way that he wrote it and the starling wrote it, and the starling made a couple of changes. It added a couple of sharps where they didn't belong and made it sound a little bit starlingy. But other than that, it's very, very clearly Mozart's motif. And although this is a story that's not often mentioned in biographies, when biographers do speak of it, they say, oh, Mozart must have been, you know, really distressed or angry because clearly somehow his music got out in the world and he was very jealous and paranoid about others stealing his work. But at the end of this little notebook entry, instead of writing, oh my God, you know, why did this darling do this? He writes, and you'll have to forgive me, I don't speak German, but my approximation is Das war schön, which I'm told means that was wonderful.
So we're talking about a European starling, so far anyway, but somehow, some way, they get to America, and we have Shakespeare to thank for that. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah, that's another one of those myths that is most likely true. So in 1890, there were 20 starlings that were introduced into Central Park in New York. And they were introduced by this pharmacist named Eugene Schieffelin, who was also kind of an Anglophile and a Shakespeareophile. And he was really on a mission to introduce all the birds from the Shakespearean canon into the New World. And he had tried introducing starlings before. Starlings were mentioned just in one little line in the whole of Shakespeare. In Henry IV, Hotspur is mad at the king for not paying a ransom to free his brother-in-law, Mortimer. And so he kind of storms off in a rage and he says, as his revenge, he says, "I'll have a starling taught to say nothing but Mortimer," and whisper it into the king's ear. And so from that little line, we have the hundreds of millions of starlings that live today in North America. So that introduction in Central Park from just 20 birds has grown into the population of starlings we see today. DNA evidence shows that all of the starlings, and it really is a couple of hundred million, there are so many that we scientists really can't even count them all or even estimate accurately the scope of their numbers, but it's at least that high. And all of those birds grew from that tiny founding population. It's amazing.
I was interested in learning more about how Europeans decided to move into the pet bird business or pets in the household in general. And you tell an interesting story about a couple of philosophers that we've all heard and probably had to study in school at one point, Descartes and Rousseau. And you highlight the philosophical difference between the two of them in the way they viewed animals. And that apparently had something to do with the fact that Europeans all of a sudden decided animals should be part of human existence and in our households. Tell us about that philosophical difference.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It was a time of a great kind of bridge in our thinking about our relationship to animals. So Descartes was a rationalist, and his view is actually still very common in scientific circles in which animal research plays a part. And it allows people, I think, to sort of shut out some of the current thinking about animal consciousness. And I know you've had some of the people on your show that are thinking a lot about that these days. But Descartes said that in speaking about animals used in scientific study, like dogs that were used to study internal organs, he said their crying is nothing more than the squeaking of a door, nothing more than that. When Rousseau came along and wrote The Social Contract in 1767, it was partly in response to Descartes. And he had, although it was kind of still a romantic view of the human relationship to nature, it was one that responded to a deep sense of consciousness and intelligence in the natural world. So it was still not, a modern ecological understanding, but it was one in which the humans participated in an unfolding intelligence and could learn about the divine or God, Rousseau would have said, through our understanding of what we can observe from the natural world and wild animals. And he felt all of them had a kind of consciousness or intelligence. So Rousseau kind of invited in this idea of humans participating in kind of a garden-like view of the world. And so it was at that time that more plants and natural history curios and even birds were brought into the home to sort of invite that sensibility into the upper middle class and eventually the middle class parlor. And bird keeping caught on very quickly. In fact, some people, this is kind of a wonderful detail I uncovered, is that in Mozart's time and place, people carried little tiny cages around their house with canaries or other birds that sing a lot, like bullfinches. So it was sort of like their version of a boombox or an iPod that they carry around to have music in the house, but it was a live bird in a portable cage.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Seattle naturalist and writer Lyanda Lynn Haupt, author of Mozart Starling. So tell us about the ability of the starling to mimic. And here we're going to go to your own personal example, because what the listener does not know yet is that Lyanda Lynn Haupt copied Mozart, brought a starling into her home named Carmen, and the rest is history. We're going to talk a little bit about Carmen, but let's start with this mimic thing. I mean, when I read that it was related to the minor bird, I could get that because I've seen minor birds in cages in pet shops, and clearly they're repeating everything you say. Never in a million years did I think a starling could do the same thing.
Yes, they're closely related to starlings, and minas are closely related, and starlings are incredibly gifted mimics. So they will imitate, as I said, environmental sounds, human voices, music, other animals, other birds. Mates will imitate one another, and family groups of starlings use mimicry to sort of deepen their bond or deepen the bond from mate to mate. In starling social situations, it has very deep significance that we're only just beginning to understand. But we're just even coming to terms with the fact that they're so good at it. So living with a starling who I was going to say we didn't teach her to say anything, but the truth is I tried really, really hard for the sake of this story to get her to learn the motif from Mozart's piano concerto, the same one that his darling learned, because I thought it would be great for the narrative and, right. You know, Geraldo would come and all of this. But what happened instead is that she had no interest in learning that motif, and she is, like many starlings, has a complete, well, like all starlings, has a complete mind of her own about what she chooses to mimic. So she did start with the phrases that she heard most often. So the first word that she learned was hi, and the second word she learned was her own name, Carmen. So she started saying hi, and then hi, Carmen. Hi, honey. She meows like the cat. She beeps like the microwave. She makes a whirring sound like the coffee grinder. She makes mysterious sounds that I often, you know are mimicked because I hear her kind of learning and practicing them and then getting really excited about sharing them, which is sort of her process when she's learning a new phrase. And I won't know what it is until I'll be going through my daily round and suddenly I hear the sound and go, oh, that's it. One of those is the squeaking of our old wood oak floor outside of her cage. Another one is the stopper on the vacuum for the wine bottle. That's one of the first sounds that she learned, that kind of ew sound. Sure. But one of the things that really amazed me about her mimicry, Bob, is something that I didn't expect. And because I didn't expect it, it took me way too long to learn it. And that is, most of the time, she mimics in context of what's going on in our family life. So I'll give you an example. I'm the first one in my house to get up in the morning, and it's still a little bit dark. I'll look into her aviary, and she will hop to the edge, and before I even say anything, she'll say, "Hi, Carmen," which is the very first thing that I would say to her. And then our cat will come downstairs wanting her food, and Carmen will look at the cat and say, "Meow." And I'll go over to make the coffee, and as soon as she hears the tinkle of the coffee beans in the jar, she says, "Kerklunk, whirr," which is the sound of the lid from the coffee beans hitting the counter, and then the coffee grinder sound. And when we open the microwave door, she says, "Beep, beep, beep," pitch perfect. So she's responding, she's participating orally in our lives all the time. She's alert to that. So I think about that when I walk into the world and in urban places, we're seeing starlings. I just think of this great consciousness and vocal and aural awareness that's surrounding us that we're not even aware of. It's beautiful.
So share with us how you found Carmen, and perhaps you could share with us the law on taking birds out of nests.
That is the first thing I was going to do when you asked that question, actually. Yes. So basically the lesson is, do not try this at home. So all birds in this country, with the exception of just a couple species, are legally protected. So it is completely illegal and also unethical to touch, disturb the nest, eggs, nestlings, or adults, for that matter, of any species in North America. There are a couple of exceptions, and one of them is a starling. So not only because they're an invasive, non-native, and ecologically and agriculturally damaging species, not only are they unprotected, but the Fish and Wildlife Department actually encourages us to discourage them from nesting in our homes. And we're allowed to remove eggs, nests, and nestlings and kill as many starlings as we like without permission, even required. The one thing that we're not allowed to do to a dog is to take a starling and raise one in your household. It's illegal in most states to keep a starling as a pet. So far, the starling police have not come to my door, even though I very publicly outed my crime.
I guess.
But it's a funny little thing, and I talk to a lot of wildlife officials about it, that you are allowed to kill starlings, but you're not allowed to just take one. And their response was that they don't want people propagating starlings, which makes sense because their numbers are out of hand and they are such an aggressive and damaging species. But in my experience of talking to people that in there's sort of a starling keeping stealth community, I'll say, in the country. And almost everyone I've talked to that has a starling is raising a bird that they found orphaned or injured and has no inclination to propagate it, but is just has just this one-off kind of pet starling living with them. And that's certainly the case with us.
So you mentioned some of the reasons why starlings are pests. You mentioned the ag issue, but there's also the nature issue, I guess you could call it, where the starlings are nest robbers, and there is a concern that they're out there taking somebody else's nest, and will that somebody else, then a more valuable bird, really have a place to light? You have a little bit of a countervailing approach to that argument, don't you?
Well, yeah, and it's not actually my argument. So one of the main ecological issues with starlings, and one of the reasons that they're just hated by birders, bird watchers, they are really the number one most hated bird in North America, probably by ecologists and conservationists and birders. And the reason is they're cavity nesters, and they're pretty big for a songbird, and they're pretty aggressive. And so they outcompete more sensitive species and native species for these really valuable and rare nest sites. Like, cavities are something that woodpeckers will excavate, or you'll find them in the corners of houses or naturally in decaying logs, but they're not something you can just build like a nest, like most birds can build a nest. Cavity nesters need these kind of uncommon little cavity nest spots. And so it is worrying when starlings take those over or throw sweeter little birds out of them. But it was a Cornell ornithologist who did a study. His name's Walter Koenig, and he is at Cornell now. And his study over a decade or more showed that he studied many of the species that were believed to be most impacted by starlings. And he hates starlings himself, and has seen some of the acorn woodpeckers that he studies himself displaced by starlings. So he is a avowed starling hater. And he was sort of surprised and also a little disgruntled to come out of the other edge of his research having to say, you know what, I just can't document any actual decline in the species because of the presence of starlings. His conclusion was that when individual birds are tossed out of their nests or outcompeted by starlings, that they just, for the most part, go and nest somewhere else, that they're not just unsuccessful for the year. So starlings are a little bit vindicated. The only other thing, and I still, as a conservationist, I hate the presence of starlings in this country. I wish that we could get rid of them. But I guess my argument is that it's not going to happen. There's too many of them. We've tried for certainly decades to get rid of them with poisons and guns and sounds and anything that our science and imagination can come up with. And they are still incredibly successful. So as long as they're here, I think that we can kind of take that complicated path of understanding that they're ecologically devastating, but as individual animals, they're wonderful to watch. They're beautiful to look at. And they can teach us a great deal about animal intelligence and consciousness in a way that's really easy to observe because they are so common.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and my guest is Lyanda Lynn Haupt, author of Mozart's Starling. So speaking of how beautiful they are to look at, let's look at them in mass. You have a little section in your book where you talk about this huge mass of starlings moving together through the sky. I think it's called murmuration. Could you help us understand how that works? I mean, how can so many birds, thousands of birds, figure out a way to all move together without running into each other, I guess is the point.
It is, and it's so such a good question, Bob, because at the end of the summer, starling family groups start to break down. So in the summer, we don't see these flocks. They're off on their territories and they're with their young. But as fall approaches, those family groups break down and the starlings start gathering in these bigger and bigger flocks that they use for protection and to find food together and to evade predators. So flocking has all kinds of benefits, but starlings just take it to this high art in this beautiful kind of mesmerizing patterns they make. And you're right, when we see them, they swirl from one side to the other. And if one bird went the wrong way, they would crash and they'd fall out of the sky and die. But it never happened. And sometimes these flocks have literally tens of thousands or 100,000 birds in them. And so they take up a great deal of space in the sky. And people couldn't figure out, both scientists and watchers across, you know, Europe where they were native or here. So this is literally a question that spans hundreds of years. No one could figure out how they do it. And it was only in really the last decade that our sort of computer modeling and observation all caught up with everything to understand that, well, there's a lot going on. And a lot of it is way beyond me in terms of, you know, mathematics and physics and chaos theory. But one simple part of the story that came to light is that every starling in the flock, when it moves slightly, it affects the seven starlings closest to it. And they have super quick reflexes, and that movement scales incredibly rapidly through the flock. Mm-hmm. And so you see these movements happening and the ripples forming with this beautiful seed idea that one starling affects the seven starlings closest to it, which is lovely and fascinating. And as I said, there's much more going on to it than that. But that nugget really stuck in my mind because the metaphor, I mean, it might sound really cheesy, but the metaphor is kind of irresistible and true that we all have our version of that. You know, we have in our life and our work and our music and our art, we have our own version of the seven starlings next to us and the way that our movement and actions ripple into the world. I think in this time of this political extremity, it's lovely to remember that we start close in and what we do carries forth.
Absolutely. So Mozart's bird, you named him Star in your book, although I guess no one's really sure what Mozart called him. But Star dies after 3 years, and relate that to Mozart's life and death mainly, and what we have of that in classical music today.
Right. Well, one of the wonderful parts of this story, both sad and compelling, is that Star, the starling, died 3 years after Mozart bought him. 2 months before that, Mozart's father, Leopold, died. And he died in Salzburg when Mozart lived 250 miles away in Vienna. And, you know, might not seem that far, but on, you know, carriage and bad road, and when you have a wife with a septic leg and two kids and concerts to perform, it's actually really far and a really expensive journey. And so Mozart didn't make it. He did not attend his father's memorial in Salzburg. And biographers have made a great deal of this and kind of blame it on their fraught relationship and the fact that Leopold had such an authoritarian hold over Mozart. It's very true that their relationship was complicated. But when you read their letters, you see that there was also just a great deal of respect and love there. And the way I read it, after a lot of thought and careful reading of the letters, is that Mozart just wasn't able to go, that it's not that he didn't want to, it's just that he couldn't. And it was only 2 months later, into this really sad time, that his starling died. But for the starling in Vienna, he gave a formal funeral in his garden, in his yard in Vienna, and he hired mourners or had friends come and wear formal funerary garb, played flute music, and he composed a poetic elegy for the bird, a poem just on the occasion of the death of his starling. And a lot of biographers have said that it was just a farce, you know, that it was appealing to his, you know, sense of humor, which I'm sure that it did. And a lot of biographers say that, you know, it was a channel for the grief that he felt over his father. And I think, you know, that's possible too. The vessel of the funeral might have been very powerful for him and kind of a makeup funeral. But, you know, after living with a starling, the third possibility I realize has also to be absolutely true, that he loved his starling. I mean, Carmen is mischievous, charming, intelligent, friendly, entertaining, and her presence is just a delight in our household and family, and it would have been for Mozart as well. And I believe that he was just really sad when he died.
So tell us, how old is Carmen? How long will she live in captivity? And you might even tell us the little story of once upon a time when she didn't think she was going to live in captivity, and she escaped.
Yeah. Right. Well, so Carmen just turned 4. Uh-huh. And so that's a good age for a starling. And starlings in the wild are a little bit long-lived compared to some songbirds. They can live 6 or 8 years in the wild. But in captivity, anything can happen. So they're protected from, you know, wind and rain and finding food and all of that. So in that way, they can live longer and, you know, have a better chance. But in some ways, their chances at living a long life are decreased because they don't develop a strong immune system. And, you know, Carmen's a little scrawny compared to birds that fly really long distances. She flies around in the house and she does get exercise, but she, you know, doesn't have to do all of the exertion, you know, engage in all the exertion that wild starlings do. So they say that domesticated starlings can live to be 15 years of age when they're living indoors. But I had this strange experience. I was doing a reading from this book in the Bay Area, and I read a bit from that elegy, that poem that Mozart wrote for his starling, and a woman in the second row started to cry. And I said, what's wrong? Is everything okay? And she said, I'm just sad because it reminds me of my starling that died a year ago.
Oh my gosh.
He lived for 24 years.
Whoa. Wow.
I know. So that's kind of a long time.
Yeah.
But we are committed to Carmen can't be released into the wild. You know, she thinks cats, we live with a cat. She thinks it's her friend. She thinks she's a human, or she thinks humans are starlings. She doesn't understand about the starling social life, which is really important to starlings surviving in the wild. So we are committed to making sure she has a good life, however long that will be. But yeah, once when she was very young, under a year old, my husband was in the kitchen and doing up the dishes, and it was warm outside, and he had the windows open, and he let Carmen out of her aviary to sort of dance around the kitchen with him. And he hadn't thought about the windows, which we usually are really religious about closing. She flew straight out the window and around the house and was gone, and he couldn't find her. And I came home, and he sheepishly told me what happened, and we walked all around the neighborhood saying the only word that then she had learned, hi, and hi, Carmen. We walked around yelling hi, and we just thought she was lost. And starlings that are raised indoors get lost pretty easily because they haven't learned the map of the neighborhood. Like, they usually learn that by following adults around. So even if they want to come home, if they fly too far, they can't get home. So I was worried that we would, after all the travail of raising her, which I go into in the book, that she was gone at only 3 or 4 months old. But it turned out that she just flew around, and she flew way high into the top of a evergreen tree in front of our house. And eventually we just started hearing this contact call that baby starlings or young starlings make that she innately knew. And Tom put a ladder against the house, and as soon as she saw him, she flew to his shoulder and clung to him. So that was tragedy narrowly averted, and we've been a lot more careful with the windows since then.
Well, you've written a delightful story. There's not many books where I can say by the time I finished it, I touched on science, philosophy, music, nature, and a few other things, and we can't cover them all in a brief half hour, but I want to remind our listeners, the name of the book is Mozart's Starling by Lyanda Lynn Haupt. Lyanda, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Lyanda Lynn Haupt. Next week, Kurt Anderson, author of Fantasyland, How Americans Went Haywire, a 500-year history. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.